Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we want to talk about inflation, right? You're hearing more and more from Republicans and the radical right and their media and their paid-for economists saying, oh, we're spending too much on the recovery, too much fiscal spending. It's going to generate excess inflation very soon and very significantly, and that's going to derail the recovery, right? That's an excuse, of course, to cut back on the programs designed to jumpstart and stimulate the economy. I'm talking about the three programs that Biden has proposed, Democrats proposed. One has been passed. That's the American Rescue Plan, sometimes called COVID Relief, passed earlier, I believe it was in March, $1.9 trillion, they claim. Actually, it's only $1.8. And according to the Congressional Budget Office, only $800 billion, or $1 trillion of that, rather, will get spent this year for stimulus, actual stimulus. And as I pointed out, you know, a lot of that's going to be hoarded by those who really don't need it, or state and local governments, you know, are going to sit on it and not spend it immediately, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really only $800 billion actual stimulus, which is, you know, not even 4% of GDP. It's a minimal stimulus program. I don't think it's sufficient, and certainly not sufficient to generate inflation. And then, of course, there's these other two programs that are just talk right now. The infrastructure or American Jobs Act proposal by Biden, another couple trillion. All right. But that won't even become law until next year. And then there's the most recent Family Leaves Act proposal by Biden, about a $1 trillion. That, too, won't come until next year, if at all. So this year, you know, there's only $800 billion stimulus. And we saw $800 billion here in at the end of December, emergency passed. And that dissipated within a couple months. By early March, it was effects were gone. So this, you know, actual $800 billion in American Rescue Plan COVID relief is not going to have a particularly big impact on the economy, and certainly not enough to generate inflation. The same Republicans, by the way, in 2017 passed a $4 trillion tax cut for investors and corporations and businesses in the wealthy 1%, and they didn't think anything of that and its effect on the economy. Well, that didn't have any effect on the economy hardly at all either. Tax cuts don't. When you're in a deep contraction, tax cuts are worthless stimulus measures. You need to generate jobs, and you need to generate wage income. They could have given a big boost to the economy this year, $400 billion, by raising the minimum wage, but no, they're not doing that. Anyway, you know, the fiscal stimulus bills, spending, are not what they appear in the media. They're not even here yet, and they are not going to be as large in their total spending effect as the media claims they will. Okay, you know, this whole argument about inflation due to excess spending or excess money injected into the economy is based upon this classical economics phony notion that inflation is the result of too much money chasing too few goods. You may have heard that phrase, right? That's a favorite phrase. Too much money in the economy and not enough production for the goods. So there's more demand for the goods that are available to sell. So if there's more demand and there's not enough supply, businesses, of course, would jack up their price to sell what they got. I mean, that's, you know, economics 101. Freshmen taking their first econ course are taught that, right? Supply and demand determines price. Well, supply and demand plays a role, but it doesn't determine price necessarily. And what's more important is what determines supply and demand. You see, that's the real fundamental causes, not supply and demand. That's an intermediary cause. But let's look at that. Too much demand, i.e. too much money by households, right? And government putting money, you know, in checks and unemployment benefits, extras and so forth. Oh, too much money. The folks that have lost their jobs and their lives have been devastated are getting too much money. Unemployment benefits are too high. Oh, the government's spending too much, injecting too much money into the economy, and they're going to spend this and drive up prices. Too much money chasing too few goods. Well, let's look at that. Okay. You could argue two ways, too much money. Right? You could say, well, the Federal Reserve, the central bank, has injected too much money into the economy. And factually, over $4 trillion since this thing began, the Fed pumped into the economy through its bond buying programs. And it's continuing, $120 billion a month, for as far as the eye can see, according to the Fed. They don't want to say when they're going to change it. So $4 trillion, you know, and trillion plus more, trillion and a half going on this year, and next, maybe, 2022. Well, that's too much money, you could argue, being pumped into the economy. It's going to cause inflation. But that assumes, you see, that the Federal Reserve, central bank, injecting of money actually gets to the households and consumers to spend to drive up prices. But that's not where it goes. No, no. All that almost free money, because it's at near zero interest rates, the Fed's charging, right? And most of that free money goes into financial markets. Or it's borrowed by businesses, banks and businesses, and it's given to shareholders and dividends and stock buybacks. Or is borrowed by multinational corporations that take the money and invest offshore, or it's just hoarded. Does that drive up consumer prices? No. I'll tell you what it does drive up. It drives up financial market prices, stocks and bonds and so forth. Yeah, that's what it drives up, because that's where it goes. Oh, but conservatives and businesses don't say that. They don't want you to know that all that trillions of dollars of free money is going into financial markets. And it's causing inflation in financial markets. Well, come on, we're talking about trillions and trillions of dollars in just one year going into the banks and into businesses. No wonder they're not hurting. Okay, well, there's another way you could look at too much money chasing too few goods, another way. And that is, well, you know, isn't the federal government, Congress, injecting $800 billion this year into the economy? Isn't it doing that? Another way of saying excess money for the amount of goods available. Yeah, you could say that. And isn't that going into households, not into corporations? I mean, unemployment benefits and the checks and so forth. Yes, right. You know, the $800 billion, $1 trillion estimated by the Congressional Budget Office authorized to spend this year, $800 billion actually get into the economy, right? Most of it, or a lot of it, will be saved by upper income groups. You know, U.S. savings is at somewhere between $2 and $3 trillion. It's usually about one total household savings, but now it's, you know, $2, $3 trillion. Well, it's being hoarded. It's not being spent. Well, in addition to that, the money will be used to pay down debt. Well, that doesn't stimulate the economy. And then, of course, as more and more workers go off of unemployment benefits as the economy reopens, right? The amount of that $800 billion allocated for unemployment benefits is going to go down. So that amount isn't going to get into the economy. And even average households, you know, the upper income level, you know, they play around with investing in stocks, some of them, you know, day traders and so forth. Not a big figure, but nonetheless. Yeah, that's going to $800 billion getting into the economy or less. But that's not significant, you see. $800 billion in the $2 trillion dollar economy, you know, is less than 4% of GDP. That's not significant in terms of being sufficient boost to overall demand to drive up overall prices. So neither, summarize here, neither the Federal Reserve injecting of money into the economy is going to boost prices in the real economy. I'm not talking about financial markets, but the real economy, you know, nor is the $800 billion or less actually sufficient in boosting demand to drive up prices in the real economy. So this notion that too much money chasing too few goods for the real economy is nonsense today, given the context of the contraction and the crisis that we are in. It's nonsense. That's not how inflation occurs. Now, let me be clear. We will get price increases. We will. We're just not going to get it from demand side. Household consumers demand. It's insufficient. And the Fed's money goes elsewhere. Well, if we are going to get inflation, where is it going to come from? Well, I'll tell you, it's not from demand. It's from supply side issues. Supply side. Let's review some of these. Why prices are going to rise, but it's not going to be because of households with so much extra money they're going to demand to drive up prices. Supply side. Okay? There are big problems with supply chains going on, causing shortages in business. Shortages. Supply chains. The COVID has wrecked the global supply chain system. What do we mean by supply chain? Well, you know, raw materials, semi-finished goods, a lot of it comes from China and places like that, raw materials from emerging markets and so forth. That is broken in many cases. You can see it very clearly in what's called the semiconductor sector, right? They can't get enough chips, semiconductor chips from Asia. And what's that doing? That's causing the auto industry and the auto companies to not able to increase the supply of autos. You know, they're selling automobiles hand over fist. They can't sell enough of them right now. But what's happening? Well, we got a supply problem because we got a chip problem. You know, a lot of semiconductor chips in these cars now today. And if you can't get those chips, the supply chain is broken, well, then you can't make those cars to sell those cars. And last month we've seen that, 30,000 workers were laid off in the auto industry in these numbers, which we'll get to, the jobs report. 30,000 laid off? Well, they're not increasing production, which means that they can raise their price because there's a shortage. You know, prices increase. If you want to talk about supply and demand, excess demand drives up prices, but insufficient supply also drives up prices. And we got problems with supply, which is really behind what's going on with inflation that's beginning to emerge. Another problem with supply is businesses themselves, across the board, have cut their inventories. Inventories are, you know, the storage of goods that they've produced over immediate sales, and they store these goods in an inventory in expectation that they'll be able to sell them in a week, month, whatever, down the road. Well, during COVID, businesses cut production and their inventories to the bone. Well, people weren't buying what they could produce. They were laying people off, so they cut their inventories. Well, now we got a problem of shortages because there isn't sufficient inventories that have been stored up. Inventories collapsed during 2020, and they even continued to contract in the first quarter of this year. So businesses aren't building up, you know, their inventories, their store of goods to sell. They're very skittish. They don't know if this thing is going to dissipate again, this rebound, like it did last summer. They don't know how far it's going. They're being very cautious and careful, and they're not adding to their inventories purposely. Well, that creates shortages and gives them the opportunity to boost prices. And that's what's going on. You see, businesses and certain sectors in particular are testing the market, raising their prices, in some cases more than can be sustained, to see how much demand there really is for their goods. Why? Because they want to recoup the losses that they had, great losses, in 2020. They want to recoup those losses. So they're raising prices. You know, there's three ways that you can increase revenue and profits. Three ways you can increase your profits. It's that simple. All businesses, three ways. One, you can sell more of the stuff you got, right? For that, you need strong demand. You can raise prices on those goods. For that, you don't necessarily need strong demand. Or you can cut costs. It's that simple. Every business has to figure out how to cut its costs, right? How and if it can increase its prices on what products, and how it can sell more, create more market share. How it can sell more, marketing and whatever. It's that simple. Okay. Well, you know, businesses are trying to raise prices now across the board to see how much of those price increases will stick. They have no idea yet, because no one really knows what's the condition of the economy. But they're betting that the economy is opening up and more workers will have at least some income, and that will stimulate demand for their products. So they're trying to preempt that and jacking up their prices. And sometimes quite a bit. You know, I just got my bills from the damn insurance company, house insurance and auto insurance, and they've jacked their prices up 20%. 20% in 1 year, 20-25%. Utility companies are doing the same. All across the board, this is going on. So this attempt to boost their prices, you can see it too in gasoline prices going up, right? Speculators driving up the price of metals like copper and aluminum. That's going on because they think there'll be more demand for it in the future. So they're speculating and driving up the price. You know, these international commodities, the prices there are driven a lot short term by speculators buying up the contracts and creating shortages so that the prices rise and then they sell their contracts at a higher price than they bought them. So commodities, intermediate goods, copper, aluminum, other metals, gasoline prices, oil prices, you know, that's inflation being driven by speculators. So companies are testing the market, raising prices, and speculators are driving up the prices for inputs by buying up the contracts, right? And businesses are trying to recoup the losses last year, not only losses due to inability to sell the goods they had, but they had to drop their prices. In some cases, it was deflation. You know, when you have a low level of prices and prices actually contract some in a crisis like last year, right, it looks like, oh, prices are really rising in the subsequent year to this year, but they're really just reversing the deflation that occurred. You know, the negative prices. Housing prices are accelerating, right? Why? Is it just demand for houses? Well, there's some of that. But the cost of lumber and all those other materials are going through the roof because of shortages, because of supply problems. Right? There's not enough houses to be sold. Supply problems. Right? And to some extent, there's labor shortages in some service industries. You know, workers want to go back for in restaurant industry for $2.13 an hour minimum wage. No. Okay. So, in other words, businesses are going to have to pay higher wages if they want to get these people back. Oh, but they're whining and complaining that, oh, you know, we can't get workers back because the unemployment benefits are too generous. You can't get them back unless you want, unless you're going to give them a decent work week with decent hours. Not part-time and maybe one or two days, a half a day. You know, if I'm a restaurant worker, why would I want to go back if the employer says, oh, come back for 2 days for 4 hours a day? Why would I want to come back and then maybe get laid off again and have to file for unemployment benefits all over again and risk not getting them? You know, if businesses really wanted workers to come, raise your wages, and they'll come back. Give them, you know, a full day's work. They'll come back. Stop whining that you want to continue paying them COVID depression-level wages. That really irks me, you know. They expect people to continue the work for poverty and sub-poverty wages and to come back for that and not knowing how long those jobs and those sub-poverty wages with fewer hours are going to last. Well, people aren't stupid. But that's really what's behind all this whining and complaining by some businesses of, oh, you know, not enough people are willing to come back and work. Yeah, they're willing. But don't think you're going to be able to get people for starvation wages anymore. Okay, so, you know, to summarize, we got a supply side problem in many forms out there, and that's behind what price increases we're going to see and beginning to see. You know, it's not all that great yet. Come on, you know, inflation's not appearing significantly, but to the extent it does, it's going to be a supply side issue. It's not going to be a demand side issue because $800 billion is not sufficient to really generate sustained inflationary pressures. Larry Summers, to the contrary, you know, Larry Summers, this pro-banker economist that was able to convince Obama not to spend on households. And that gave us that terrible economic recovery under Obama, right? And he's out there again, and he's peddling his myths. You know, oh, it's too much money. We can't absorb that. We can't spend that. Well, he did the same thing under Obama in 2009, got Obama to reduce the stimulus. You know, he was behind a lot of that, and he's behind it now. Well, he's a friend of the bankers. You know, a lot of these economists out there are friends of big business, and they get a lot of media coverage, you see. It's, you know, the economists that are more pro-households and consumers and workers who don't get coverage in the media. But they, you know, the other guys get a lot of coverage. Okay, so supply side, to summarize, we got supply chain breakdowns. We got inventory collapse, right? We got companies attempting to simply test the market with price increases and speculators driving up prices for intermediate goods and resources, right? Housing prices, we got shortages of materials, right? And we got some labor shortages in some areas as well going on. Also, you got to realize that the price level, right, rises or falls due to the composition of imports in the total consumption mix, right? If import prices for import goods, and there's a lot of that coming into the country, rise, right, then, the total price level in the U.S. rises. So to some extent, any increase in inflation, the price level, is going to be due to rising import prices, not domestic demand. Well, why will the import prices rise? Well, the goods coming from China, they may try to, in the recovery, get more revenue for it by raising prices. But the price of import goods will rise if the value of the dollar falls. And it has been. That alone, declining value of the dollar will raise the cost, the price of imported goods relative to domestic goods. So there's a component within inflation, measured price levels in the U.S., that's due to rising import prices. And that's due, in turn, to falling dollar, which has been falling, partly due to the Fed keeping interest rates near zero. Okay. All right. So, it's supply side, far more than demand side. Let's look at problems next with U.S. price indexes, right? How the U.S. estimates inflation. And I will argue that it underestimates inflation purposely, consciously. Why would it want to do that? Why would the government want inflation to be registered as lower than it actually is? Well, for a number of reasons, because the government, if prices rise more than reported, then the government has to pay more Social Security. It has to pay more in other contracts, right? And all of that has the effect of increasing the budget deficit, right? Food stamps, pays more for food stamps, pays more for cost of living adjustments to government retirees, pays more for school lunches, right? So the government has an incentive to keep prices low, as low as it can. And they lowball inflation purposely. Okay, so what do we mean when we say the price index or the measure of inflation? Well, there's multiple and indexes, and they're all calculated differently. They all underestimate. Which one are you talking about when you talk about inflation? Well, the one that people hear about most is called the Consumer Price Index. Right? But the Consumer Price Index doesn't measure inflation. I'll explain why. Oh, but there's others called the Personal Consumption Expenditure Indicator, PCE. Not just CPI, there's PCE, right? And then, of course, there's what's called the GDP Deflator Price Index. And then there's produced prices, wholesale prices, commodity prices, retail prices, import prices. There's lots of indexes, measures of inflation out there. Which one are you talking about? Well, you mostly hear about CPI, Consumer Price Index, as the indicator of inflation. Right? Well, let's take a look at CPI. What actually does CPI measure? Is it an accurate indicator of inflation in the U.S.? And why not? Okay, so the CPI is really only 450 items that households mostly buy. Okay? 450 items, right? There are millions of items, goods and services of various kinds out there. But the government, the Labor Department, only looks at 450 of them, a basket, they would say, a basket of the most bought goods, right? And they sample like 80,000 of these. They send people out to look at grocery stores. They send people out, you know, look at department stores. They send people out and call, right, call companies. But mostly they go out and inspect to see, you know, how much the prices have changed from month to month. Now, how accurate is that during a pandemic? Huh? How accurate? The stores are closed, right? The restaurants are closed during most of 2020. Well, you could call an airline company and they could tell you what the price is for a flight, right? But a lot of this, the basket of goods, right? If they are determined by going out and surveying, and you can't survey, well, how accurate is it going to be? Okay. One. Second point, right? This basket of goods has weights in it. In other words, the lodging or rent factor, right, is going to carry more weight than, you know, buying a toothpaste. Why? Because households spend more on lodging than they do on toothpaste. So it's going to get a bigger weight, a bigger effect when they're adding it all up and estimating it in inflation. The problem is the weights change, and they really change dramatically, or should have changed, during the pandemic. What people were buying was really changing, but the weights did not change. You see, the weights were based on, what, 3 or 4 years previous. They only changed the weights every 4 or 5 years. So we go into this pandemic, and the things people were buying as a percentage of the total spending shifted, but they didn't pick this up. Apart from the data collection, you know, whether you can go out there and ask when these stores are closed what's being charged, it's a problem. The waiting factor got distorted by pandemic. The data collection factor got distorted by pandemic, right? The sampling. There's also a problem called the quality adjustment problem. This is called hedonic pricing, right? Quality. You know, what the government does is that if a product was significantly increased in price during the period, and the quality, in other words, the features and things offered with it was even more increased, well, then they would register that actual price increase in the market as a price cut. Oh, we got to adjust it for the quality improvement, they say. You know, if your PC or your cell phone has more features and functions in it, right, and Apple raised the price $200, well, it's got so much more functionality, the government would say. Let's say, you know, the cell phone item was really a price cut of $50. See, that game is played on. They adjust for quality, or they're unable to accurately adjust for quality. I mean, you know, it's kind of arbitrary to say how an improvement in a product really translates into a price increase or decrease in that product. But they do that. It's another reason why the CPI is not a good indicator. Waiting problems, data collection problems, quality estimation problems. And what about new products that just come on, you know, come on and should be in the basket of goods, but, you know, are just introduced, but aren't, because we only adjust it every 4 or 5 years. Yeah, well, that's not picked up. And then there's another problem called substitution bias. What is that? Well, if a product goes up significantly in price, consumers will look for a substitute product that may not have gone up in price, or certainly goes up in less price, or they wouldn't be substituting it, right? Well, the fact that the original product had a significant price increase in it is not picked up. because the consumer price index is not really a measure of inflation. It's a measure of household costs and spending. That's what it measures. So if households are substituting cheaper products, right, the CPI is not increasing as much as the inflation rate really is increasing. That's an important thing to keep in mind, right? There's no adjustment in the CPI for rising import prices due to the falling collapse of the U.S. dollar. And we know people are buying a lot of import goods, right? But as the dollar declines because of the Fed pumping too much money into the economy, as the dollar declines in value, right, import prices rise in value. And that import prices, to the extent they are included in the basket of goods, increases the basket of goods simply because of the change in the value of the dollar. Nothing to do with supply and demand. Another problem with CPI is that it only measures urban households, big city households. Right? The survey is done in big cities. And that leaves out, you know, what is the inflation effect in rural and, you know, exurb communities. It doesn't pick it up at all. Right? It doesn't segment the inflation estimates by race, by income, by age, or gender. Doesn't break it down. You know? I mean, the CPI, let's say it's 2.2% here, is for everybody on an average. But what about middle-class households? That 2.2 might be 3 or 4% for households. The basket of goods increase hits middle-class households, or poor even more, harder than it hits upper-income households. So there's no segmentation. You know, we segment the employment, but we don't segment the price data in any way. It excludes mortgage rates, by the way. CPI does not include mortgage rates. It underestimates the increase in online shopping. It doesn't include any Social Security taxing, you know, or income taxes. Some indirect taxes are included, property taxes, but, you know, not all tax increases are included in its estimate. And there's no financial assets in the estimate. Now, this is a long list of problems with CPI, but I'll tell you the biggest problem. The biggest problem is how the government estimates all this is kept a secret. Yeah, they won't release to the public all the statistical manipulations that they do to come up with these price indexes, whether it's CPI or PCE or whatever. It's kept a secret. Yeah. I mean, unemployment estimates, you know, that's all public. They explain, you know, in footnotes how they do it, but they don't explain how they do it for inflation indexes. Well, why is that? Oh, they got a phony excuse that, oh, if they did that, it would reveal companies' pricing secrets and pricing methodologies. And they would, you know, be, harming companies that their competitors would know about their pricing. Well, hell, their competitors know about their pricing anyway of each other. You know, it's all over the internet. Prices are all over the internet. There's no problem of revealing company secrets of how they price their products. But they keep it secret from the U.S., from households, from the rest of us. Yeah, why? Well, they don't want you to know all the games they're playing with it. You know, how they estimate prices, consumer prices and so forth, has changed 20 times since 1990. And all the changes are mostly done to smooth out and reduce the actual rate of inflation, to reduce it. For reasons I explained, you know, it's more expensive for the government, the more inflation. And by the way, the more inflation, the higher the inflation, the lower the real GDP numbers. I talked about that last week. When you adjust for inflation, the lower the real GDP. So if inflation is really higher than reported, real GDP is really lower than reported. And that's what's going on. You know, the data last week, you know, came out for GDP. I talked about this in last week's course, whatever, right, on GDP, the show. Go back and listen to it. How the reported 6.4% annual rate in GDP growth in the first quarter was really 1.6 because of this phony use of annual rate. They take the actual quarter and they roughly, rule of thumb, multiply it by four, you get 6.4%. It's really only a growth of 1.6% in first quarter, which came on a growth of 1.1% in fourth quarter, which are both way below historical averages, showing the economy is really quite weak still, you see. And by the way, if it's weak, you're not going to have a lot of demand driving inflation. Yeah. So, you know, in how they estimate inflation is very important. And if you lowball it by changing the ways, you know, 20 times how to come up with a lower number, smooth it out, as they say, right? Smooth out the volatility. Well, you're going to get a phony number. Inflation is actually much higher than they report, right? And there are problems. Problems with the CPI, the way, you know, I went through them all pretty much, you know, the weighting factors, you know, the quality issue, new goods, substitution bias, right? No adjustment for declining value of the dollar. The urban only surveys the urban economy, households in the urban areas. How the hell can you survey that? When everything's shut down, it doesn't segment, so you can see how hard it's hitting the middle class and the poor would be higher than the actual true number. Right. Doesn't include mortgage rates, right? Underestimates online shopping price increases, et cetera, et cetera. But mostly it's kept a secret here, right? For phony reasons. Well, that's a problem with the CPI. And you got similar problems with the other two major indicators, the personal consumption expenditure indicator. That's what the Fed uses to estimate inflation, right? And it has a different approach to weighting and makes adjustments to weighting more frequently. But the PCE comes in consistently lower than the CPI. And we saw that the CPI lowballs inflation. Well, the PCE comes in even lower than the CPI. And then there's the what's called the GDP deflator, which is lower than both the CPI and the PCE. The deflator, as they call it, really looks at not just a basket of goods, but looks at all the prices of business goods, intermediate goods, business selling to each other, as well as consumers. So it's consumer goods and business goods. But, you know, there are millions of goods, business goods and consumer goods being bought and sold at all times in the economy. How the hell do they know? Well, they don't do a survey on the GDP, right? They estimate. They're statistical measures, and the statistical measures lowball are designed to lowball the actual numbers. They got this thing called chain pricing with GDP. What is that? Well, that think of that as you get an average price for a product and you average out the average over the years. Well, that certainly dampens the inflation quite a bit. Yeah. So chain pricing on the GDP deflator is another way of lowering the actual price inflation number. A lot of problems to sum up here. A lot of problems with you know, all these price indexes here that they don't tell you about, and they keep it secret. Keep the data processes, how they come to these conclusions, secret with the CPI. And the CPI, once again, does not measure inflation. It measures consumer spending, household spending in urban areas. That's what it measures. But the measurement is all out of whack because of COVID, because they can't gather the data accurately. Just as they can't gather the data on jobs accurately. COVID has screwed it all up, screwed up all their methodology. You see, all you know, whether it's jobs, employment, or prices, whatever, this is not the actual raw number of prices or jobs or unemployment. No, this is a statistic. They take the raw data and they engage in all these manipulations of that data. And the more manipulations they do, the more they can play with it and to lowball it. And they do. But yet it comes out in the media as, you know, the absolute truth, you know. Oh, unemployment was this. Oh, this is what price increases are. No, no. Statistical manipulations on the raw data. They don't tell us the raw data. Well, you can get the raw data for unemployment, right? You can get that. And employment, but not for prices. You can't get the raw data for prices. No, it's a secret. Yeah, and they got a phony way of justifying it as well. Well, let's talk about jobs here. Jobs report came out today for April. And whoa, was it a surprise? You know, they were forecasting, economists were forecasting, million to 2 million new jobs were supposedly created last month. Right? Well, keep in mind that the data for April and every month is really the 12th day of that month. That's what they call April. It's really March 13th to April 12th. That's what the April number shows, right? Well, the economy may have opened even faster after April 12th, but that's not in these numbers. But the numbers were a shock. They were expecting over a million. All these economists were forecasting over a million jobs created in April. And the number came out 266,000. A shock, big shock. And even the numbers for March were reduced by 78,000. Big shock. What's going on? You know? Well, the Labor Department is having trouble with really estimating employment and unemployment, just as they are with estimating prices. You know, the unemployment numbers are determined two ways. Well, unemployment two ways, employment levels two ways, unemployment level one way. Employment is determined by what's called a enterprise survey. About 400,000 or so enterprises report to the government, Labor Department, you know, what their hiring is, how many jobs they added or didn't add, 400,000. Well, there's about 10 million businesses in this country. Right? And to determine the unemployment, you're not going to get it from, you know, a lot of small businesses aren't picked up in the enterprise survey. So the government goes out and surveys the 60,000 actual households to see if they're working or not working. Right? And that's how they get the unemployment numbers. Not the employment, but the unemployment numbers is from a survey of households. Right? Now, the government, Labor Department, shot itself in the foot when COVID began and its whole survey process because it created a category called employed but absent from work. Think about that a minute. The government calls households and it says, among other questions it asks, it says, were you employed but just absent from work? Well, if you're absent from work, you're not working. You're unemployed, right? But they append the word employed. And, you know, a lot of workers were furloughed by their company, weren't permanently laid off. They were furloughed. They weren't getting paid. They're unemployed, but they think they're still employed by the company. So they asked him, are you employed but just absent from work? And millions said, yeah, I expect to go back. Well, you're unemployed. You should be added to the unemployment numbers, but not according to the Labor Department. You know, they created that absurd oxymoron category in their surveys of people. And it distorted. It reduced the unemployment numbers. Because those folks, if you're not working and you're not getting paid for it, you're unemployed. Sorry. That's what it means. You're not getting paid. You're unemployed. But you're not, according to the government. Well, you know, the Labor Department last May of 2020, admitted, oh, this was wrong. We shouldn't have asked that. But did they correct it? No. They never correct their errors in the Labor Department. Almost never, right? They just kept doing it, asking that question. So you got millions of people who are really unemployed, but think they're just absent from work. Yeah. Well, a better indicator of what's going on in the job market is the actual data, not a statistic, but the raw data on how many people are filing unemployment claims. Every week that comes out, new claims for unemployment benefits, new claims. You know, in the first quarter of this year, they were running at 1 million a week, new unemployed filing for benefits, 1 million a week. And we easily had 20 to 25 million people really unemployed at the beginning of this year. And of course, all throughout last year, even more. And at one point, I think it was well over 30 million, 30, 35 million even, at the worst time in spring 2020. That's a lot of people, right? So, you know, you had 20 million people at the beginning of this year getting benefits, 1 million plus a week, 1 million, 2, 1 million, 3, filing for the first time for unemployment benefits every week. And that's not a statistic, you see. That's a data. That's a data point. That's raw data, actual people filing. No statistical manipulation on that number. It's an actual number. That's the difference between raw data and statistics, you see. Raw data is what you collected. Statistic is an operation to change the number of the raw data. Well, you know, the statistic is much more, I mean, the raw data is much more accurate. And that came out last month, still, you know, 498,000 initial filings for state unemployment benefits and over 101,000 for the supplemental federal unemployment benefits, you know, for freelancers and gig workers and so forth. So still 600,000 first-time filings. Yeah, it's down. It's down from the million-plus first-time filings earlier in the year. And that reflects some people going back to work. Okay, that's going on, no doubt. But 600,000 every week, you know, that's not a robust recovery here indicated in the economy. So collecting unemployment benefits weekly, new claims, is more accurate. Also, there's other statistics even that are tell you really what's going on more accurately than the jobs number. Issued every first Friday of the month by the Labor Department, you know, like the employment population ratio and the labor force participation rate. I'm not going to get into those, but all those show problems continuing. You know, new unemployment claims, problems continuing in the labor markets. All of a sudden, you know, Labor Department monthly employment numbers were beginning to look rosy here in March and April, all of a sudden collapsed. Economists were forecasting 1 million plus and only 266,000. To show us how inaccurate and guesstimate that most economists do with the labor markets, because the labor markets are all screwed up. They don't know really what's going on. And the government doesn't know either. And their numbers reflect it, right? We got 4 million people dropped out of the labor force. Well, they're still jobless, but they're not considered unemployed. You know, if you drop out, you're not looking for work last 4 weeks. You're not considered unemployed. Another oxymoron definition we got in the U.S. here. Right? We got a lot of moms still not working who were working. You know, they have to take care of the education of the kids because they're not opening up the schools. You know, are they opening them up for 2 hours a day, 2 days a week? That's absurd. You know, they better get those kids back to school full time. It's a big problem there. You know, you're not going to get women back into the labor force till you get the schools back functioning 100%, right? And you got a lot of early retirees retiring early because of the pandemic. Well, if you're retired, you're not considered in the labor market and unemployed, right? So that's a problem. Well, the Federal Reserve says there's 10% unemployment. Oh, the Labor Department says there's only 6.1% unemployment. Well, if the Fed says it's almost twice as much, I'm saying it's at 15 when you count people who dropped out of the labor force and all the new claims and the inaccuracies here with employed but absent from work nonsense, right? You know, it's 15% unemployment at least, you know, out there. You know, there's probably somewhere between 18 and 20 million people still jobless. Well, some of them are coming back, right? But very, very slow. And that's typical of this kind of a Great Recession 2.0. It took 7 years to get back to job levels in 2007. It took 7 years. It wasn't until 2015 that we got the same level of jobs. And they were lower pay, by the way, compared to the jobs we lost. Well, we're going to have the same thing. It's going to take years to get these jobs back. Years. Okay, so that's my critique, you know, of the jobs numbers and the problems in those jobs numbers that you got to take with a grain of salt here whenever they come out, whether they are overestimated or underestimated, you know, take it with a grain of salt. And also with the inflation, you know, debunking this notion that, oh, inflation is because of people got too much income driving up demand, right? It's demand-driven inflation caused by all this stimulus. No, it's supply. It's supply issues that have nothing to do with the stimulus, which is insufficient anyway to drive up inflation. Inflation is going to occur, but it's because of business trying to recoup losses, testing the market, and because of supply problems that we got. Okay, that's the educational on government stats now. Next week, I'm out.